Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Well, my next guest is a marine scientist and a surfing champion who has dedicated her life to minding our oceans whilst tempting us into them. Eesky Britton, good afternoon from our Sligo studio. How are you?
Hello, Derville. Yeah, thrilled to be here with you.
Absolutely. Well, look, you were named after a wave. You had an Irish granny who imported surfboards from Malibu into Ireland in the 1960s. Saltwater is literally in your blood. Remind me, first of all, about your remarkable family history and how you first hit a surfboard when most of us still had our little plastic armbands on.
Yeah, it was a remarkable way of life to be born into. I was literally like born into the water and the sea. Myself and my sister were born to surfing parents who pioneered the sport of surfing in the Northwest. And yeah, and my dad was one of five boys. And as the story goes, my grandmother, who ran the hotel, Santice Hotel in Rasnala at the time, was promoting tourism in America in the 60s. And it was also the height of that kind of, you know, the heyday of modern contemporary surfing in Malibu in California. And so she was there at the time of Beach Boys and Gidget and all of that, and saw surfing for the first time at Malibu, and made the remarkable connection with the surf she saw in Malibu with the waves in front of her hotel in Rasnala. And then somehow I was inspired to get two of some of the first Malibu surfboards back into the country.
So How did you do that?
Yeah, there were these 10-foot surfboards as well, like pretty unwieldy. I'd love to have a conversation with her about it now, but I'm not entirely sure. But that in itself would have been a huge feat. And then, of course, these, you know, incredible looking craft landing in, you know, in Donegal, and my dad, who was 12 at the time, and his brothers seeing them, it was, yeah, I could only imagine the excitement. And I think my grandmother more intended it for, you know, for tourists and for to put up in the hotel on display. And she said she always regretted turning her sons into beach bums, especially my dad, Barry, who still surfs to this day. But yeah, they sort of started experimenting with them in their childhood. And it was about a year before they realized you could actually stand up on them when they saw a visiting surfer. So a lot has changed in Ireland in terms of our relationship with the sea and surfing and the world indeed since then.
I have to ask, Eesky, what wave were you named after?
Well, I named after Eesky, the place on the west coast, actually near here now in Sligo. And I have a real affinity with the place. It's one of my dad's favourite waves. But I also love about it, the name obviously comes from the Irish word for fish. And it's named after the important Salmon River that comes out there and actually shapes one of the waves at the river mouth. And so I have a real affinity with the mythology of the salmon of knowledge and that whole connection, I think, to, I suppose, the importance of connection to our more than human kin and things we can learn about when we really immerse ourselves in our environment, and we observe species like the salmon and learn from how the waters are doing. So that was just really instilled in my name early on. And now looking back, I can see how it's totally influenced my life path.
Well, completely, because you went on to become a big wave riding record breaker. You have 5 consecutive Irish national surfing championship titles, and you've travelled the world over, Iran, Hawaii. Are you still chasing those big waves, and are you still in awe of the water as much?
I am eternally in awe of the water. I think my chasing waves around the world has definitely been tempered by becoming a new mum
to
twins recently. So
congratulations.
I'm on a whole other adventure there. Yeah, sharing the wonder and awe of the ocean with them now.
And what do you do there now? Like, I mean, presumably they've been in, probably not surfing, but presumably they've already been immersed in salt water.
Yeah, we're very lucky. I'm back home in Rasnala. And so they're just over a year old. And it's beautiful to be able to pass on that connection and love of the sea.
Yeah, I think your grandmother, Mary Britton, would be thrilled. Now, today you were going to speak to us, Eesky, about water and how we can all enjoy it and become its, you know, protector in our own areas and elsewhere. Do you find it? And we just had a big discussion before you came on air, you know, about climate. But is it more poignant for you now that you've become a mum, now that you have the twins, when you consider the human impact on the environment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm something I grapple with every day, thinking of the future they'll inherit and how do I make it a more beautiful one than what we're currently facing into, which was much of the motivation behind writing my latest book, Ebb and Flow. But really at the center of my work is looking at that. Like, it's about relationships and about our connection to the natural world, to water, to place, and about restoring those lost connections as I see them being at the kind of crux of a lot of the crises we're facing into. So, and the questions I ask are, what if the health of our water, the health of the earth, is a reflection of our own human health because we're so entangled? And what if restoring our relationship with the waters on the earth was a way to restore and heal our own health? So the area where most of my research is currently focused is looking at what's called blue health. So those kind of...
Because it has become a bit of a buzzword. Iski, what does it actually, for anyone who mightn't be in the know, what is blue health?
So essentially, it's kind of a meta discipline across health environment sectors, looking at primarily the physical and mental health and well-being benefits of being in, on, or near water. So the effect that water has on us, why does it seem to have that innate pull? What are the healing and restorative benefits? And now that the science has come out to really strongly support how water environments are the most psychologically restorative of all environments for humans.
Right up to, I know many people turn to the water at times of grief, but look, I mean, it's now been deployed for treating trauma, even by the US Marine Corps.
Yeah, I think it's such a fascinating area of research, and it's really supporting that importance of that story of our ecological interconnectedness. Like, when we really connect and immerse with something like water, which is alive, and the impact it has on us in terms of our health is just remarkable, astonishing. And even closer to home, like here in Rosnail and Donegal, I work with Liquid Therapy, a charity who are really engaged in delivering surf therapy programs. So, like, increasing that access to the ocean to access the restorative benefits.
And a lot of surfers, Iski, would say that it's a very, it might seem a bit risky for most of us, but a lot of surfers will tell you that it is a very meditative practice when you're out there on the waves. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it has so many benefits on so many levels. And I think, part of it, you mentioned, like, why, especially when it comes to trauma, I think one of the fundamental things, if you look at trauma, what it does, it causes a disconnect with our bodies. And then we sort of disconnect and disassociate from a lot of, engaging with things in our lives around us. But what water seems to do in a really kind of powerful way is sort of bring us back into our bodies so that we can begin to sense and feel who we are, how we're doing, and in a space then that just really allows us to feel all of our feelings and emotions. So that's what comes up again and again in the research, is that powerful place of self-connection, this emotional release is happening. And then there's also the part that I find really interesting. It isn't just how it can, like, boost our mood and make us feel better, but it's that we're entering a challenging environment, and it's often, in Ireland, it's often quite, uncomfortable getting into cold water. But we're now finding that that's part of what makes it so transformative. It's like having to learn to be comfortable with those discomforting feelings, even the fear, initially people might feel. And so when we move through that, it creates this incredible adaptive resilience in the body when we kind of have this low dose exposure, as it were, to stress even. So we're actually able to overcome that stress response, which then builds resilience and confidence in so many other aspects of life and when we come ashore and face other challenges. So we're seeing that in particular for young people. It's really important and beneficial.
And this book, in one sense, Iski, is sort of a roadmap on how we can find that resilience in the waters around us. But do you think a lot of us approach water just as a resource or a commodity, or do we not kind of see that other potential that it has?
I think so. In short, it very much in our modern society has become this, as you rightly say, like a commodity, a thing for our use. We don't give much awareness to, the water that we come into contact with in our everyday lives. And of course, when we think of, connecting with water, we can imagine, the power of the ocean, the, rivers, waterfalls, all these really appealing kind of outdoor wild spaces and places. But actually, you know, the question I get asked most often is, well, how do I connect with water, you know, if I live in a city or inland, or people who maybe, you know, don't have the benefit of having the ocean on their doorstep. And I just like to think about how we ourselves are bodies of water. You know, we're over 50% salt water. And then just even beginning to think about where that water comes from, the water we come into contact with in the morning when we splash our faces, and the effect that that's having on us straight away. The water that's coming out of our taps, where does it come from and how is it doing? And so it just sort of start to unpack all these ways that water touches our everyday lives, and then ways we can begin to, I suppose, bring back in that kind of culture of care and reciprocity.
And obviously the culture of care, particularly in relation to our oceans, it has been just, I suppose, a life's mission for you. Earlier, our panellists were talking about the recent marine heatwave in Ireland, which obviously doesn't augur well for the future. From your life as a surfer, as a marine scientist, you have a perspective that perhaps many of us don't have. But what are the biggest changes you are seeing in respect of what is arguably one of the world's most important resources?
Yeah, it's hard to pick one.
Like, do you notice the difference if you're out surfing? Yeah. Like, I mean, over the last 20 or how many years you've been surfing, like, I mean, do you see a physical difference in the ocean that we perhaps can't appreciate because we're not surfers?
Yeah, I think maybe that is the gift that comes with, say, being a surfer, someone who has that connection with water. Like, when we engage with water, immerse ourselves in it, we quickly realize that what we do to the water, we do to ourselves. The importance of engaging with that kind of water work to protect water and these natural environments that are really mirroring our own health. So I guess to answer it, there's a few things. I mean, one, as a surfer, you're kind of trained in being an observer of natural phenomena, of weather, of learning how to read essentially the language of the ocean. So you're looking always for different like patterns, and to be able to predict swells and waves and when they'll arrive and things like that. But now that's just becoming increasingly difficult to do. There's just more and more uncertainty, the breakdown of those patterns in terms of weather systems and storms that we would have kind of relied upon, and now it's all very unfamiliar. But the other thing that I kind of feel really confronted with is what a writer of mine that I love, Robin Wall Kimmerer, she's a botanist, and writes how we're experiencing species loneliness. And I think that really goes to describe that feeling of that loss of abundance of life that the ocean should be teeming with. And of course we have amazing encounters with other life in the water is part of the appeal as well, but it's definitely diminished. And there's these moments of that when I experience that jilt of looking up and there not being big flocks of seabirds, or the migrating birds that come back, and just noticing there's less and less. And if you're not immersed in it all the time every day, you maybe the shift might seem gradual, so you don't notice it. But actually, in just my lifetime, it's really profound, the decline in the number and abundance of different species, which is really worrying as we head towards tipping points.
And do you despair, Iski? Do you worry that we're too late, or can we still move to protect our oceans and our waterways?
Yeah, it's a constant like pendulum swing between despair and hope. But I like to embrace a more active form of hope. I mean, that was part of the motivation of also like writing the book was, and as I was writing Ebb and Flow, was actually discovering there's whole like communities coming together to take collective action around restoring water bodies, and just the kind of multiple benefits that has for our own health, but also that in terms of our own like culture and spirituality. So that gives me great hope. And it's kind of like looking at it as these series of which get seriously underreported, all looking at the Earth as a series of these hope spots that are lighting up. And we actually have our own hope spot now. Of course, the Skellig Islands have been designated most recently by Dr. Sylvia Earle as a hope spot. But they're really important, I think, and to look to what's working well and the solutions that people are that are, you know, of what's possible, of looking at all we can save rather than all we can lose.
After reading your book, it's really fascinating. But I thought this is going to be a challenge for the bookshops, because where are they going to put this book? Is this memoir? Is it spirituality? Is this environment? I just didn't know where, because you infuse so much of yourself in it. And one of the big, obviously, there's a clue in the title, ebb and flow, but you sort of address that in both a literal and a metaphorical sense, and an acknowledgement that life isn't always in flow.
Yeah. I suppose it's in the title, isn't it? The importance of that ebb state. And maybe that's part of, in a way, what gives me hope is the importance and the need to value more of that inner work for each of us as well, especially when the outer world is becoming increasingly uncertain. In our society, I think those ebb states are really undervalued. So if you look at ebb as a state of rest, or that those periods of like in between, when I'm surfing, like the times when you're not surfing a wave,
it's all in the waiting.
Yeah, and how we show up in those moments really determine whether we're able to access, say, our peak flow, or how we're able to move into action when it's necessary. But we can't be on all the time. And so it's also this, I mean, the urgency is there, but that constant drive to do and to push is increasingly leading to burnout across the board. So I think when the energy and mentality that we bring when we're addressing these challenges that we face, it's really important that it becomes much more cyclical than it is now. So honouring both the ebb and the flow in how we address the challenges even.
And managing the urgency, and then the taking time to reflect. Meditation in all its forms seems to be something that has been important to you in your life.
Yeah, and that's one way, I suppose, to honour the ebb. And increasingly, they're just little like pockets of stillness, like micro moments in what is, I know for many, a very busy life, but especially when you're like a new mum to twins, it can be, the thought of being able to sit and meditate is feels like an absolute luxury, but it becomes even more of a necessity. So I know just...
How do you meditate when you have twins who are less than a year old?
Well, what's really fascinating is actually, and the science is backing this up now, that even if you take a, you know, as I call it, like a microdose of those like blue space moments, or if for me, if it's even just taking like three conscious breaths, you know, mirroring say the ebb and flow of the tide, or acknowledging how every second breath I take comes from the ocean, that's enough sometimes just to give me enough of a reset. So even just doing that for 60 seconds. And then if I can't get fully immersed in the water, of even just going like barefoot and grounding that way. So there's ways of still, still finding those little pockets to reset.
I am a twin. I don't think we gave my mother much moments of meditation in our early years. I wanted to talk to you about the fact that we did embrace water, particularly during the pandemic, whether it was getting to a surfboard for the first time, lots of wild swimming, lots of sea swimming. It really, really seemed to take off. Did you like to see that, and do you think it's here to stay?
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the more powerful kind of and unexpected perhaps byproducts, but maybe not so unexpected. I think we intuitively know and feel like it's in us as humans that we're drawn to those spaces and places that we know where we can receive healing. And no surprise that that tends to be water for a lot of people, and certainly nature. So I think that was a real positive. And now it's looking at how do we continue to foster that and begin to engage in that kind of more intentional way with water, so that we're realizing that every time we come into contact with the world around us, with water bodies, that there's this interaction and exchange happening. And so it's as much as the impact of water on us as what are we bringing when we're going to these places as well.
Can I talk to you about women and water? Because a lot of the myths, the goddesses, the names even of bodies of water are female. Why do you think that is, or what is that strong connection with water and women?
Yeah, that was another interesting aspect of water to uncover, our relationship with it when I was writing the book. And it was, yeah, there's just very much that synonymous. And if you look at Irish mythology, how so many of our rivers are named after goddesses, you know, the Boyne named after Boann, and the Shannon and all of them. And you see that pattern repeated all around the world. And it comes from the, I suppose, acknowledging and recognizing the life force and the life-giving properties of water, water being the source of all life and being this animate life-giving energy that we depend on for like nourishment and sustenance, in the same way that we were all grew in water and were carried in water in our mother's wombs. So there's that still that really powerful connection there. And then,
were you conscious of that, having recently given birth to to twins, and how was that for you?
Very conscious of the shaping powers of water, both drawn to it for my own kind of, you know, sanity and respite, and with the one place, you know, kind of floating in a body of water where I could feel like my body relax during pregnancy, but also then noticing just how much the body in my, or the water in my own body, was changing dramatically and increasing in volume, and how thirsty I constantly was, but how it also altered my relationship with my own immersion in the sea and surfing in ways I hadn't expected either.
In what sense?
Well, during the pregnancy, I surfed for the first trimester, and then I think primarily trying to get in and out of a, you know, winter wetsuit is hard enough with navigating a bump over twins. But yeah, it was just
a potential product line for you there, Issa.
Right. But I think it's the reason I'm drawn into the sea for me is to feel that sense of, I suppose that it's in order to feel good in your body. And then when that's not there anymore, it just became, okay, that's not the thing to do anymore. And also felt increasingly for me, your whole body and brain is being rewired. So I was no longer surfing for just myself. I was surfing for the three of us. And there was like a whole other level of responsibility there. So my attitudes and behaviors were shifting, you know, to find, go out in days that weren't busy or surf smaller waves or avoid risk. And now I would say, you know, afterwards, because you go through such a profound transformation that I didn't realize of,
what you're expecting, or motherhood not what were you expecting?
Well, there is an awful lot around pregnancy and birth, but next to nothing on the journey women will go through in the afterbirth. And that's just been such the most profound revelation, and really unsettling, because I feel like we're very unprepared for it, and how new mums experience that journey. It can be really isolating then, because we don't understand maybe a lot of the changes we're going through. And then I was lucky.
In terms of your body, or in terms of
everything?
Everything.
So I saw it mirrored in my relationship with the sea, is obviously that one constant in my life. And I'm always kind of, I'm curious then when that changes or shifts. So it was a massive shift then in early motherhood. In physically, obviously, it took a long time to recover. But then psychologically, just that rewiring in the brain altered everything in terms of my motivation and desire, what was driving me. The drive was kind of gone, and the pull was much more about that seeking that sense of pleasure and body connection, and just that moment of just being beginning to feel myself in my own skin again, or in this new skin, as it were.
Did it surprise you
completely
or even that lack of, what I'm kind of hearing from you is maybe that lack of support for new mums in that quite vulnerable stage, just after they've, you know, given birth and they're literally trying to get back on their feet? Is it, did you see a gap there that could be filled?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of just shocked to read. I mean, obviously, as a researcher and a writer, I'm like reading lots around it. But just the lack of research that's there on this most in, I was so surprised, because it's obviously something, a journey that women for all of human history have been going through. And there's so little in terms of the research on the experience and becoming a mother, that whole new identity, psychologically and socially, as well as physically. And we're just beginning to understand, in terms of very, very recent research, I'm talking the last 5 to 10 years, on the changes, even in the rewiring in our brain, obviously the huge hormonal shifts, and how we do become whole new beings, you know, which I found, of course, played out then when I was surfing, in terms of the the rewiring in my brain, as it were, was just a total, my level of perception was altered. Even the ability, I think, even to take in information through my senses, like my ability to hear things, smell things, see things, all of that actually gets heightened during pregnancy and early motherhood. So that was fascinating.
Seems like there could be a sequel on the ebbs, the ebbs and flows of early motherhood. I was fascinated by the fact that there's some beautiful illustrations throughout the book, and then I found out they were yours as well. So a marine scientist, surfer, and an artist as well. Of course, there's a big artistic connection in your family, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that I've definitely inherited that from my dad, Barry Britton, who's an amazing artist himself. And it was just wonderful to be able to have the ability to include that in my writing. So a really supportive publisher to do that. And I find for me, the drawing and the art is just like my own kind of personal form of therapy.
One of two, because I also believe that you've trained as a trapeze artist, or that could have been a career for you?
Well, you have definitely dug deep. Yes.
We have a great research team here.
Just that sort of phase in my life where I was just trying to experiment and experience all the different things I could do with my body, I suppose, in my 20s. That had a real appeal. The Irish Aerial Dance Festival is held in Letterkenny, of all places, every year. And they offered me a chance to experience what it would be like to run away with the circus one day. I didn't. The sea still had a bigger pull. So
it does indeed. And it has reaped so many benefits for you, and I'm sure for many others who will draw much from Ebb and Flow, which is published by Watkins. It's in shops now. But for now, surf champion and activist Eiske Britton, thank you so much for chatting to us. We wish you all the best. We're going to take a quick break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.